Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The threat of ISIS is the topic of conversation around the world today. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with French President François Hollande and other world leaders in Paris to talk about the global response.
Meanwhile, lawmakers are meeting on Capitol Hill today to talk about authorization for the U.S. to train and equip Syrian rebel fighters, part of the strategy President Obama outlined last week to combat ISIS. Here is White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough being asked about U.S. boots on the ground by Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press.
There's not a single military advisor that has come to you guys and said you can defeat ISIS without some combat troops, ISIS in Syria without some combat
troops. That's correct.
Right? That's a fact.
That's a fact, and that's the president's view, and that's why what we need Congress to do right now, and frankly, we're seeing very good progress on this, thanks to the speaker and to others, is to put together support for what the president calls a Title 10 program to train and equip the Syrian opposition on the ground fighting ISIL.
But some are voicing concerns that rebel boots on the ground won't be enough, and members of the House plan to leave Washington at the end of this week to campaign ahead of the November midterm election. So the countdown clock is on in Washington. Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent at NPR, joins us now with more. And Ron, what can we expect from today's meeting in the House about authorizing the U.S. to arm and equip Syrian rebels?
Jeremy, specifically, we're expecting the House Rules Committee, which is a powerful body in that body, to meet this evening and to discuss what it has been essentially handed by the House Republican leadership, which is a deal being worked out with the administration to respond to this request to arm and train moderate or vetted Syrian pro-Western, if you will, forces who are anti-Assad. That is, they have been in rebellion against the president of that country. And at the same time also opposed to ISIS, who have been one of their rival groups there in Syria. This is what the administration wants. This is what the military wants. This is what we expect Congress to pass, but there are many hurdles to be cleared first.
And what about the Senate? If this passes through the House, would the Senate pass it?
The Senate is, of course, always a hurdle in its own right, and their rules are more difficult than those of the House. And even if the leadership of both parties supports something in the Senate, it can be more complicated. Just today, we've heard Senator Rand Paul, the junior senator from Kentucky, who has been outspoken in many instances regarding American military commitments overseas. Rand Paul was saying it's a mistake to get involved with any more of these Syrian rebels, that when we have trained them and armed them in the past, many of the armaments have wound up in the wrong hands, in this case, in the hands of ISIS.
Which is something, by the way, that Senator Mark Begich of Alaska, a Democrat, told us just on Friday on this program, that he thinks it would be a mistake to arm Syrian rebels because they may end up not being on the same side as the U.S.
That is right. And, of course, we have also heard reports in the last day or so that at least one of the supposedly pro-Western or moderate Syrian rebel groups that is not ISIS has reached some sort of an agreement, a ceasefire for the moment, with ISIS. And so it is not clear where these relationships might be moving around.
Well, Ron, a quick question about the idea we introduced at the beginning here, the concern that arming the rebels might not be enough. You know, the administration, the president has said several times there will be no U.S. combat boots on the ground. There's a lot of debate about that. Here's Democratic Senator Jack Reed and Republican Senator Lindsey Graham debating that yesterday on Fox News Sunday.
We've found, I think, for the last 10 years, that the most effective fighting force on the ground ultimately is those indigenous troops, those local troops who are fighting for their own country, for their own future. If we make this an American fight, the Iraqis, the Saudis would be gladly step back and let us do as much as we can. That's what they did after the invasion of Iraq. We have to empower them, but they have to carry the fight to the enemy. This is a fight within the Sunni community. It's a fight that they have to win for their own self-interest. And we have to make it clear that that's the case.
That was the Democratic Senator Jack Reed. Here's the Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
For anybody to suggest that we can do this with air power alone, or this is like Yemen and Somalia, is disingenuous and delusional. I want a regional coalition. I want the Free Syrian Army in the fight. I want Arab countries in the fight. But here's what I'm tired of hearing. from this administration and my friends on the other side and within my party that this is somehow easy and really not our fight. Name one Arab army you could put together anytime soon to deal with a terrorist army of over 30,000 without a substantial American commitment.
Lindsey Graham has also said, Ron, ISIS will come here and kill people in the U.S. How is this resonating in Congress with experts?
The Congress members are mostly concerned about going home and campaigning for re-election. So they have a lot of what we call messaging bills they would like to do this week. They would like to get that done. But we do anticipate that either as a freestanding vote or more likely as an amendment to the spending bill, the stopgap spending bill that will keep the government open past the 30th of September, and we've talked about that before, as an amendment to that bill, there will be some kind of support passed by this Congress, House and Senate, this week or early next week to provide this training money, this equipment money in that theater. Now, at the same time, in the public as a whole, yes, you get a very strong response to confront ISIS, confront these people with these beheading videos we're seeing on television. Two-thirds of Americans want that. But there is also a very low level of confidence that whatever we do, whatever this administration and this Congress may do, will be successful in at least the shorter intermediate run against ISIS.
Ron, another big question is whether the administration already has the legal authorization for airstrikes, not arming Syrian rebels, which they're asking for here, but for airstrikes. And they've been relying on the 2001 authorization for use of military force, which was passed after 9/11 and says it gives them authorization to go after people who are responsible for the recent attacks. We're talking about ISIS here, who obviously had nothing to do with 9/11.
Well, that's right. And the 2001 September authorization was passed just 3 days after 9/11. But a year after that, in October 2002, it was expanded to a specific authorization for the use of military force in Iraq. And since most of some of the airstrikes that we've done up to now have been in Iraq, they've been relying on that. They would like to expand the sense of both of those to make it possible for them to go after ISIS. And that vote might come after the election in a lame duck session in November or December.
Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. Thank you as always, Ron.
Thank you both.
Well, Scots will decide this Thursday if Scotland should break off from Great Britain to become independent. Today, British Prime Minister David Cameron promised Scots that if they rejected independence, they'd get new powers, including new powers over taxes, spending, and welfare services. He's pleaded with them, saying, please do not break this family apart.
So this is our message to the people of Scotland. We want you to stay. Head, heart, and soul, we want you to stay. Please don't mix up the temporary and the permanent. Please don't think, I'm frustrated with politics right now, so I'll walk out the door and never come back. If you don't like me, I won't be here forever. If you don't like this government, it won't last forever. But if you leave the United Kingdom, that will be forever.
Well, half a world away, many Chinese people find it incredible that London would even consider allowing the UK to break up. China's premier has said he wants to see a united UK. As the BBC's Martin Patience reports from Beijing, China's leaders worry that the Scottish vote may encourage its own minorities to push for independence.
The strains of Highland Cathedral. The melody is not, it has to be said, one of your typical tunes in China. But the even bigger surprise is it's been played by a Chinese bagpiper. George Tien loves all things Scottish, despite having never set foot in the country. How did you first get interested in Scotland?
I heard the music from the city and over 10 years ago, but I have no idea about this kind of instrument. So I started to find some CD and tape, and this music can make you cry and cheer you up.
Do you want to see an independent Scotland? Do you think it'd be a good thing?
I'm not Scottish. I'm not even a British. I'm Chinese, so I don't believe I have the right to choose that. Leave the right to their own people.
And while George won't be drawn, the Chinese government has already said it would be better if the UK stayed together. And that's because Beijing is wary about any independence movement inspiring its own minorities. Any talk of separation in China is seen as treason. There are no referendums here. In the western region of Xinjiang, Beijing has launched a huge security crackdown against what it calls Uyghur separatists. Tibetans have long complained that they're repressed under Chinese rule. And in the case of Taiwan, Beijing says it has the right to use military force if the island declares formal independence. Victor Gao, a political analyst, says keeping China unified remains the ruling Communist Party's top priority.
Throughout the thousands of years Chinese history, whenever China is united, we are in a better position. The Chinese economy will do better. Living standards of the people will do better. Whenever China is fragmented, or when part of China is occupied or part of China become independent of the rest of China, the result for the people actually will be a worse off.
For that reason, Victor says most Chinese find it unbelievable that London would allow the UK to split up.
London will become a much weakened entity, and whatever that will remain of the United Kingdom will be less of a player in international politics, and that in itself is a little bit unfortunate.
Unfortunate, perhaps, but as this whiskey fair in Beijing shows, the Chinese have acquired a thirst for what comes out of Scotland. Total Scottish exports, including whiskey to China, were worth more than £500 million last year. The First Minister and the leader of the Yes campaign, Alex Salmond, has stressed that he'll make Beijing a key economic partner if Scotland achieves independence. But when you ask the Chinese, or even British businessmen here about the referendum, no one will give you a straight answer. Stephen Notman is the event's organiser.
People are actually always asking, is a definite genuine interest to see, well, what's going to happen. But again, we try and just stay out and avoid that question.
What did they ask you?
Again, it can be very, very sensitive, because again, is you could obviously lead to other questions which we'd never want to or probably go down.
All politics in China is sensitive, even the politics of a small nation thousands of miles away. And while more people are enjoying a wee dram here, there's certainly no clamour for Scottish independence in China.
The BBC's Martin Patience in Beijing. Fascinating how this is resonating all around the world. You can go to hereandnow.org and let us know what you think as Scotland prepares to vote on Thursday.
Lately, football results have meant charges, not final scores. The latest incendiary case, Minnesota Vikings star Adrian Peterson, placed on the inactive list late last week after he was indicted by a grand jury in Texas on a child abuse charge for taking a tree branch and whipping his misbehaving 4-year-old son last spring. The story turned football commentators into cultural observers, particularly observers of black culture. Here's retired NBA star Charles Barkley on CBS's The NFL Today.
Listen, we spank kids in the South. I think the question about did Adrian Peterson go overboard? But listen, Jim, we all grew up in different environments. Listen, every black parent in my neighborhood in the South would be in trouble or in jail under those circumstances.
A lot of players agreed. Roddy White called what Peterson did just disciplining. Mark Ingram argued his parents gave him whoopings to make him the best human possible. But then there was Chris Carter on ESPN.
My mom did the best job she could do, raising 7 kids by herself. But there are thousands of things that I have learned since then that my mom was wrong.
Yes. Thank you.
It's the 21st century. My mom was wrong. She did the best she could, but she was wrong about some of that stuff she taught me. And I promise my kids I won't teach that mess to them.
And then this.
Take them off the dang on field, because you know what? As a man, that's the only thing we really respect. We don't respect no women. We don't respect no kids. The only thing Roger and them do, take them off the field, because they respect that.
We had to remind ourselves we were watching football. Chris Carter also said the problem cuts across racial and ethnic lines. And in 2011, Time magazine said studies suggested as many as 90% of American parents use corporal punishment on their kids. But as our next guest writes, the very idea of questioning black parenting triggers, well, a lot. Khadija Costley-White is assistant professor at the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers. Her article in the online tech website Quartz is entitled, "It's Time We Reject the Idea That Beating Our Kids Is Part of Black Culture." She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, this will of necessity be a difficult talk. It's not for all ears, so we have that warning for our listeners. But you write that the devastation of the black family during slavery shapes black opinion about just how they should be able to raise their own children. But you also write that some scholars tie beatings to slavery. Tell us more about that.
The argument generally follows that slavery was so brutal that it became a way of life, that the kind of violence and brutality and terror that occurred in slavery became normalized and routinized in a way that, you know, even to the extent that disciplining one's children kind of took up the patterns of brutality. And there's kind of a traumatic reenactment of what discipline is supposed to look like.
Well, we have other questions, but one of the things that seems to be lost in the debate over whether or not parents should physically punish their children is exactly how bad this beating allegedly was. I mean, you do talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the problem, I'm a scholar of media and journalism, and so my interest in even writing about both Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson had to do with talking about violence, the rhetoric around kind of abuse, both in terms of women and in terms of children. And so here you have people responding automatically off the cuff about the notion of beating children as natural and automatic. And what happened there that day was not natural. You know, it was a man taking a four-year-old, telling him to pull down his pants, stuffing leaves into his mouth, according to reports, and beating him with a stick. You know, he sent text messages to the mother of this child saying, yeah, I think I got him, you know, on his testicles. And so I think, you know, we need to really know what happened here in terms of the kind of brutality that this child endured.
Well, there were open wounds and the child had to go to the hospital. And it's the child reportedly that's alleging that the father put the leaves in his mouth. This wasn't just a, and there are those who are against spankings, but this wasn't just a spanking. The hospital was involved, but also a grand jury refused to indict Peterson in May, and then the prosecutors brought another grand jury to indict, and they did indict. That right there tells you that there's such a difference of opinion on this.
Absolutely. But I mean, it goes again, you know, I went back to slavery for the first part, but this also goes back to, you know, our history. Children weren't seen as people who have rights throughout the 19th century. It kind of was a new idea. Child abuse became kind of invented with the rise of the x-ray kind of coming alive, allowed people to really start being able to see and through kind of evidence and physical evidence what happened to children. And so we have a real and lasting kind of notion that children aren't real people, that they can be treated as property, and that they're the domain of their parents. They're under the supervision. And people don't like that to be questioned.
Well, the questioning really began in the 1960s, but bring us up to date now on the black community, which we know doesn't speak as a monolith. But what are you hearing from people in the black community about why they might have to be more of a disciplinarian with their children?
People think that, you know, I have to get across to my child how serious this is, right? That black children, and we know this to be true, don't have the same amount of room for mistakes. And so parents really want to get across the seriousness. And in that, I think they end up with much harsher practices when it comes to physical discipline.
Yeah. Well, and what about the research on the effects of physical disciplining on children?
Yeah, there are a lot of there's a lot of research on, especially children who experience trauma like this little boy did, that they grow up anxious, that they're more likely actually to end up in jail, that they're more likely to be depressed, and you know, all sorts of, you know, ongoing trauma that endures not just throughout their childhood but through their adulthood.
Well, but now we're hearing these well-known black men debating discipline of children on football shows, and you hear this almost confusion. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that. You know, black men who have been told in the past, you've got to stand up and raise your children. And now they're feeling as if, wait a minute, I stood up and raised my child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. People don't want to question black fatherhood. There's this notion that there has to be a black father in the home in order for children to kind of get this ability that they need. But in truth, it can't look like this, right? Charles Barkley is absolutely wrong. And I am so grateful for Chris Carter for really stepping up and saying, I'm a survivor and I'm going to tell you that this is wrong. You know, I also am a survivor of child abuse. And so there's more trauma being inflicted with this kind of of discipline than anything else, you know, than any sort of benefit. And we have to really face that. No one teaches us where the line is when it comes to abuse and when it comes to spanking. And so we end up kind of cloaking misogyny and cloaking abuse in this rhetoric of cultural rights. And really, actually, it only serves to further harm folks who are most vulnerable, like women and children in the Black community. So we have to kind of take a deep breath and question even some of those thoughts around the importance of Black fatherhood. What we're talking about is we need good parents, and we absolutely have to teach them that it is wrong to take a child and to beat them so hard and so brutally that they have to go to the hospital. We have to tell them that the strongest aren't the ones who are supposed to dominate and take advantage of the most vulnerable.
Khadija Khosley-White, assistant professor at the School of Communication and Information at Rutgers University, will link you to her essay on this topic at herenow.org. Professor Khadija, thank you.
Thank you.
And meanwhile, today the Minnesota Vikings announced that Adrian Peterson, who'd been deactivated for yesterday's game, has been reinstated. He will play this Sunday. The airline industry says passenger traffic was up this summer, and now as the busy travel season comes to an end, U.S. carriers are looking forward to the next one, holiday travel. But regional airlines aren't as optimistic. For these smaller carriers, 2014 has been a challenging year, and it might get worse. Marilyn Giewax is senior business editor for NPR in Washington. And Marilyn, start with these small regional carriers. We saw one report that said 86 cities, including big cities, Memphis, Cleveland, have lost 10% of their flights in the last year, and many of these airports are served by regional airlines. So why are they struggling?
Well, it's a real problem for those smaller cities because, you know, they want to have air service. If you're Cleveland, you certainly don't want to be losing flights. And you count on things like American Eagle, United Express, Delta Connection. Those airlines gather up people and send them to Denver, Atlanta, Chicago, those kinds of big hubs so you can get other kinds of flights. But their problem is they have rising labor costs. You know, during the recession, it was relatively easy to hire pilots. You know, the big airlines weren't really expanding. There was a recession. So they were able to scoop up lots of pilots at a relatively low cost. But now that the economy is coming back more, they can find jobs flying corporate jets or working for Sprint, Frontier, for the cargo carriers. So the airlines, these regional carriers, they want to keep serving those smaller markets, but the pilot costs keep rising and they have, you know, high fuel costs and all of that. So they're in a tough spot. And then there's one other point on this, Robin. The problem, too, for them is that when the major carriers went into bankruptcy proceedings, they often rewrote the contracts that they had with their feeder systems. And when they did that, they put tighter restrictions on the profits that the regional carriers can make. So you put it all together, some restrictions on how much they can really earn, higher labor costs. It's a tough market.
Boy, I just flew into a really small airport a while back, Lawton, Oklahoma, and you can't imagine how they'd even live without these regional airlines, and there's an army base there. So there were warnings that this would happen over debates over the recent mergers between American and U.S. Airways. Do you think this is going to make it even harder for Americans to travel and make those people who send out those warnings right?
That's a huge concern for smaller markets. You know, it's frustrating to see big cities getting all the service and the international connections and with these regional carriers contracting. But, you know, it's also true that a lot of people have just kind of gotten used to it almost. You know, if a flight if your travel is, let's say, 400 miles, a lot of people during the last recession, during all of the extra security in recent years, they've just sort of gotten used to the idea. They throw their hands up and say, you know what, we're just going to drive if it's four or five hours, you know, to get where you're going. But it's a kind of out of balance system. I mean, the whole idea of the hub and spoke system was supposed to be that these regional carriers would be the spokes. They would lead you into these hubs like a big city like Atlanta or Chicago, Dallas. But, you know, that sort of weakens the whole structure of the system. But it's also fair to mention, though, that the overall picture for airlines is pretty good this year. They really had a strong second quarter. You know, the spring was good. And in recent weeks, we've gotten more reports on how summer turned out. And travel was good. And especially for the discount carriers, companies like Southwest and JetBlue, they really saw some pretty good jumps in traffic in August. So, you know, the overall picture for the airline industry, of course, it's cyclical. It was terrible, terrible, terrible during the recession, and it's come back a long way. But there are still, you know, threats and concerns and imbalances. So
that's a bit of a problem. All you have to do is look at the headlines, Ebola, you know, more talk of war to know that. Marilyn Giewak, senior business editor at NPR in Washington on the state of regional airlines. Not good. Marilyn, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's here and now, and it's the strongest hurricane on record to make landfall on the Baja Peninsula. I'm talking about Hurricane Odile, which slammed into the tourist haven last night with winds of 125 miles per hour. Jeff Masters is director of meteorology for Weather Underground. He's with us now. Jeff, has it weakened significantly since making landfall?
Yes, it's been moving right up the spine of the Baja Peninsula, and it's down to a Category 2 storm with about 100 mile per hour winds.
Which is still pretty significant.
Oh, yeah, particularly when you've got high terrain like they have on Baja. Those wind speeds can be up to 30% higher on top of some of those peaks.
And this is the same area where Hurricane Norbert hit earlier this month. That storm ended up dumping a bunch of rain in the southwestern United States. Are you expecting the same from this one?
Yeah, we're going to see a lot of rain in Phoenix and Tucson and southern Arizona and possibly in New Mexico. And they had the rainiest day in history in Phoenix earlier from Norbert, and we're going to see a lot more rain from this storm.
Is it unusual to have so many hurricanes in the Pacific in a year?
Oh, yes. This is really unusual. In the eastern Pacific this year, we've seen 11 hurricanes, 8 of them major hurricanes. And that's a lot more than usual. Usually you only see 3 major hurricanes in an entire season in the eastern Pacific.
And what is causing that?
We have very warm ocean temperatures, about a degree Fahrenheit above average. We have very low upper-level winds, which means you don't have kind of the shearing action that usually tears storms apart. And we've got a very moist atmosphere with rising air and low pressure.
And there is another tropical storm that is building that could also hit the Baja Peninsula, right?
Yeah, there's a storm about 500 miles south of Acapulco that's gathering strength. It's not a tropical depression yet, but the models are showing it should become a tropical storm later this week. Remains to see what its track will be, though.
Meanwhile, it has been a pretty quiet hurricane season in the Atlantic, but there is one building. What are you expecting with Edouard?
Edouard, I expect to be the first major hurricane that we've seen in the Atlantic since Hurricane Sandy 2 years ago. It's close to that now. It's about a Category 2 storm, and maybe it'll be a Category 3 by this time on Tuesday.
And what's its track look like?
It's headed out to sea. It's not going to bother any land areas.
Oh, okay. So we don't have to worry about Edouard. But why has it been such a quiet season in the Atlantic?
You know, the Atlantic and the eastern Pacific are usually mirror images of each other. When one's active, the other isn't. And that's because when the large-scale pattern sets up where you have rising air and low pressure over one ocean basin, you've got to have compensating sinking air and high pressure over the other ocean basin.
All right. Jeff Masters, Director of Meteorology for Weather Underground, with the latest on what looks like a busy hurricane season in the Pacific, not so much in the Atlantic. Jeff, thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Well, communities in Colorado have been in a political fight with that state to get more local control over oil and gas drilling, a battle that was heading to the ballot box this November until a compromise stopped an initiative effort in its tracks. Colorado's Democratic governor declared the compromise a victory, but it left some members of the state's environmental community furious and vowing payback on Election Day. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Inside Energy's Dan Boyce reports.
70-year-old great-grandmother Kay Fissinger looks out over a reservoir on the edge of the town of Longmont, Colorado. Companies have been trying to put in a series of gas wells near the banks.
They'll be fracking all around here, where people play.
Fissinger has been fighting for the last 3 years to protect Longmont from fracking, the controversial technique of pumping pressurized water and sand deep underground to fracture rock and extract oil and gas. She helped lead a successful effort to ban fracking within Longmont city limits a couple of years ago. 4 other Colorado cities followed suit. The state shot back by joining a lawsuit, saying Longmont did not have the authority to enact such a ban. That's what sent activists to the initiative process, to try to earn that authority.
People are most concerned about what it means for their quality of life, their health.
This is Democratic Colorado Congressman Jared Polis. The former tech entrepreneur decided to bankroll these so-called local control measures.
It's like any other kind of industrial operation. I think it's up to communities to decide if they want to incorporate that into their economic development strategy or not.
But Polis more or less stood alone in his support. The Democratic establishment in Colorado pushed back hard, says University of Denver political science professor Peter Hansen.
The fracking initiatives were going to make life very difficult for the Democrats this fall.
Both Democratic Governor John Hickenlooper and Senator Mark Udall are locked in tight reelection bids.
And for Senator Udall or the governor to open themselves up to accusations that they were somehow opposed to energy development and jobs in the state would have been politically quite dangerous for them.
Colorado is sitting on vast reserves of shale.
While activists were busy collecting signatures for the initiatives, the industry was already spending millions of dollars in advertising to fight them.
It means jobs for Colorado.
Then in early August, on the very day signatures for the ballot measures were due, Governor Hickenlooper announced a deal.
Energy extraction and our environment and managing the balance can be difficult, but it's something we've always been able to do in Colorado.
The state would drop one of its lawsuits against the city of Longmont. Congressman Polis would drop his initiatives. The oil and gas industry would drop two pro-fracking initiatives, and a new task force would be appointed to craft a solution on local control issues for state lawmakers. Activist Kay Fissinger and much of the anti-fracking crowd immediately attacked Polis for caving to political pressures.
If you could sum up your feelings.
Betrayal. Betrayal.
Fissinger says she's been a Democrat for 50 years, but this whole thing is forcing her to leave the party.
Be a cold day in hell before I vote for Hickenlooper. It would so violate my integrity to vote for this man.
A judge declared Longmont's fracking ban unconstitutional earlier this summer, but didn't stop the activists who spoke up at a recent city council meeting.
The people of Longmont look to you tonight.
Council members voted unanimously to appeal the judge's ruling. Governor Hickenlooper announced the makeup of the oil and gas task force last week. 19 members, ranging from elected leaders to industry representatives to members of local anti-fracking groups. Matt Lepore heads up the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the state regulator. He argues the state is best equipped to regulate oil and gas, to avoid a hodgepodge of regulations. He commends the governor for brokering the compromise and says he breathed a sigh of relief.
Yes, I did, and I think Colorado should have breathed a sigh of relief, too.
Politicians of all stripes in oil and gas states have to balance the economic benefits of development with its environmental and health concerns. In Colorado, they've already taken some giant strides toward that balance. It's the first state to restrict methane emissions at oil and gas wells, and among the first to require companies disclose fracking fluid information. And now there's this task force of stakeholders across the spectrum. Other energy boom states will be looking to see if Colorado will lead on the local control debate, too. For Here and Now, I'm Dan Boyce.
And Dan's story came to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focusing on America's energy issues.
And it's a headline you may have missed earlier this month, given all that's going on with ISIS. But the U.S. military launched an airstrike in Somalia that is believed to have killed the leader of the Islamist militant group al-Shabaab. Ahmed Abdi Gadan is said to have been behind the attack last year at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya, in which four men from al-Shabaab gunned down 67 people. They said the attack was in retaliation for Kenyan forces who were fighting in Somalia. The attack is the subject of a new HBO documentary called Terror at the Mall, which uses security camera footage and interviews with survivors to tell the story. It was a normal Saturday at the mall. There were thousands of people there when suddenly they found themselves in the middle of a terrorist attack.
Where do you hide in a supermarket? Anywhere you are, you're exposed. And I kept on thinking, why now? I can't believe this is happening while I have my baby with me.
Terror at the Mall airs on HBO tonight, and the director, Dan Reed, joins us from NPR in New York. And Dan, when I saw this film, my first reaction was just, wow, it is shocking to see this video.
Yeah, you know, the material itself, the surveillance camera footage that makes up a lot of the film, was really difficult to watch. These are images recorded by a machine, and yet what you're watching is the unfolding of an event that we can scarce, you know, you can scarcely imagine. It's heartbreaking to watch the pictures that you know that we then use to make a film which shows you many angles of this one terrorist attack in a confined space.
Remind us exactly what happened on that day.
You know, it was 12:30. It was lunchtime. People were just starting to sit down for lunch. People were there with their families. You know, Westgate Mall was a real hangout and a real cross-section of people from Nairobi, from your expatriates, your UN types, to the local Asian, you know, prosperous Asian community, to African Kenyans who'd come there. Nice shops full of, you know, international brands. And it was a busy place.
It looked just like a mall you would see in the United States.
It looked exactly like a mall you'd see in the United States or in the UK. Once you were inside the mall, you were in a different world. You weren't really in Africa anymore. You were what we think of as Africa. I mean, you were in that sort of international space, mall world or mall land. And suddenly into this, you know, benign environment burst four young Somali gunmen whose mission it was to kill as many people as possible in as short a time as possible.
And as that was happening, all of the people in the mall are fleeing and trying to take cover wherever they can. It's amazing some of the video that you see in this film of people trying to crawl under tables or eight people stashed in, you know, underneath a kiosk in the middle of the mall.
Yeah. I mean, one of the really striking things about the footage was this moment of transition from normality to crisis. And it happens in less than a split second.
And I personally have never, thank goodness, seen anybody be shot or heard anyone get shot. But in this, you hear people talk about what that sounds like when it happens. We always see it on television and you hear the sound of that. But listen to this. This is the voice of someone who survived on the rooftop of the mall.
As they shot, you could hear the sound of the bullet thud into someone, the sound of the bullet going into flesh. It's like nothing you've ever heard.
It feels like somebody's being thumped, you know? And then they just drop.
And the incredible thing there, Dan, is that these people who are going through this incredibly traumatic experience are able to keep their wits about them and continue to try to survive this event.
Yeah, and in particular, I mean, it is striking to me that the women who were there with their children seemed to have, their reflexes seemed even more acute. Their minds were kind of switched to that survival mode. You know, we tell two really extraordinary stories about groups of people. One of the women, Amber, whose story is absolutely incredible, she ends up walking out of the mall.
Yeah.
A terrorist released her.
And you watch Amber walk out of the mall on video. It's incredible. After she's just been let go with her kids by the terrorists, you see her walk there with a shopping cart down through the center of the mall at a steady pace and leave. And we also hear her talk in the film about something incredible that happened after she had been hiding for more than an hour.
The terrorists had actually given them chocolate bars. You know, it's like they were trying to appease the children and explaining to them what they were doing and why they were doing it, and kept saying that we're not monsters, here, have a chocolate.
What did you learn about these terrorists in the making of this film?
I found myself wondering for a long time who these boys were and what had made it possible for them to walk into such a crowded place and just start killing without hesitation. The clip you've just played and the moment when the terrorists start asking for forgiveness and giving Amber's children these candy bars, I think that decision to release people was the result of an instruction they had over the phone from their masters, their handlers in Somalia. So there's a kind of change of policy. But at the same time, what it did was to, what the situation brought out was the kind of basic humanity, I suppose, of these boys who are just like, well, yeah, sorry, nothing personal. You know, we came here to kill Christians and Kenyans and now we're letting you guys go. And you know, really sorry about that. It's kind of not personal. It's part of a bigger, some kind of bigger conflict.
But they weren't just killing Christians and Kenyans, by the way. They were killing Muslims as well.
They were. I mean, in their initial onslaught, the gunmen killed absolutely anyone they could see. That included Muslims. That included, you know, women, children, people of every faith and every description. So it was indiscriminate to begin with. And then I think there was a further instruction, if you like, from their masters, and they were told to let Muslims go, to try and sort the Muslims from the other religions. It's interesting that one of the survivors described to me a moment when an altercation, a confrontation between one of the gunmen and a Muslim man who stood up out of, you know, the massive, writhing mass of people who'd been shot and or who were trying to escape somehow on the rooftop and started taking the gunmen to task and saying, look, this is not Islam. This is not my faith. And they got into a huge row, and eventually the gunman just shot him dead.
Yeah. But do you see a difference between what they were doing and what any school shooter does in this country, just indiscriminate shooting of innocent people?
I think there are huge similarities between what happened at Westgate Mall and, say, you know, what happened at Columbine. And this also struck me about, you know, another project I did for HBO. This is, in fact, my third terror in film for HBO. Hmm. The first was the story of 800 people who were taken hostage at a Moscow theater, musical theater,
right,
in 2002. And the second one was the story of the terrorist attacks on Mumbai in 2008.
Why have you done so many films about terror?
I'm intrigued by how people behave in extremists. I'm intrigued, you know, from watching so many movies when I was a kid, you know, how would I behave in that situation? How do people really behave?
And you see people behaving much more rationally than you might expect in this film.
You see people behaving incredibly rationally and you know, surprisingly self-possessed and surprisingly shrewd and calm. And, you know, you see other people who completely lose their bearings and you know, make mistakes which cost them their lives that were completely avoidable mistakes. And you see some people being incredibly selfish, literally, you know, stepping over other people. You see others who sacrifice their lives in an instant for a stranger. And to me, you know, this is all of human life is kind of written in these events.
Dan Reed directed and narrated the film Terror at the Mall. It's about last year's terrorist attack at the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya. It airs tonight on HBO. Dan Reed, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.